Attention on deck. The people who grow our food are killing themselves at a rate 500% greater than the rest of us. And so we pause to ask, why are American farmers killing themselves in record numbers?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1148th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, it is a very sad fact that the people who provide us with the staff of life, a food we need every day, are taking their own life and are doing so in record numbers. In fact, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention found that the people working in agriculture take their lives at a rate higher than any other occupation. The CDC data suggested that the suicide rate for agriculture workers in 17 states is nearly 500% greater than the general population. 500% greater. And Newsweek followed up by claiming the suicide rate for farmers is nearly twice that of military veterans. And some very close to farmers say the rate could even be much greater, as many farmers disguise their suicide as an accident. But it's not just happening in the USA, it's happening most everywhere. In Australia, a farmer commits suicide every 4 days. In the UK, one farmer a week takes his or her own life. In India, more than 270,000 farmers have died by suicide since 1995. Given this carnage among the people who grow our food, we simply must pause to ask, why are American farmers taking their lives in record numbers? Well, who better to ask than someone who's right in the middle of it all, and that would be Dr. Mike Rossman, who is a farmer in Harlan, Iowa, heart of the heartland, and psychologist with Ag Behavior Health. Also with us today, we have Sophia Wilmore, who is our intern producer from the University of California. So let's start off with saying a big hello to Mike. You came from a teaching background, Mike. And are now a psychologist. I think back on all of the farmers I've met, many of whom have other occupation, but none, I don't think, have had a second occupation as a psychologist.
There aren't very many of us, and good day to you and to Sophia. I'm glad to be with you. There are a few psychologists, and many of them now are younger. I know of three young psychologists, all under age 35. To me, that's younger. These three psychologists all work regularly with the agricultural population and live on farms. So that is a very positive feature about the profession of psychology and related fields like counseling and social work. Mm-hmm. There are a number of professionals in those arenas also who are farm people.
Well, you know, when you think about it, of course, the big question comes up, Why do farmers need psychologists? And I guess that's where we're going today. But let's back up a little bit and talk about your career in academia, because you were, and both you and your wife Marilyn, were college teachers at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. What fun!
It was fun, and we learned a lot.
And you gave it all up to be farmers. Did people think you were crazy?
Well, we did. No, I don't think we were crazy at all. It was a grand experiment in our lives. My wife, Marilyn, grew up in Idaho with a farming background. Her father was a farmer in Central California near Selma.
Oh, yeah.
Your territory out there. He is Japanese American, no longer with us, I should say, but he was a farmer until World War II broke out, at which point people of Japanese ancestry on the West Coast were put into relocation camps. You know about that sad chapter.
Of course, sure, we do.
Since
we also know that Japanese made great farmers for some reason. Do you ever think about that?
They were excellent farmers. Yep. Excellent farmers, and he was too. But he lost the opportunity to go back to the farm because the land that was scheduled to for ownership within the family, Japanese people could not own land at that time, but they had an arrangement with Caucasian people to eventually take over the land if that became legally possible. Mm-hmm. So when the war broke out, he had to place his tractors and automobiles and all his farm equipment into a storage barn, which mysteriously burned down 2 weeks after he went into the relocation camp.
Wow.
So that ended his farming career.
But he had a daughter.
With that kind of heritage.
Yeah, but he had a daughter who went to school, became a college teacher, married another college teacher, and they became farmers.
Yep. We were both at the University of Virginia. I was in the psychology department, and around the birth of our two children there, Marilyn worked part-time in the School of Nursing at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. We made a decision it was probably 1978 to return to Iowa, where I had family farm land. Marilyn had always wanted to live on a farm, but she didn't know that that dream would become possible for her until we actually made the decision together. We told my parents about it on Christmas Day, 1978. And by May 1979, here we were in western Iowa, living in an old, drafty, cold farmhouse with a couple of tractors, and we started raising livestock and farming 320 acres. Eventually, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it seemed like you moved from Virginia into farm country at just about exactly the wrong time.
Wrong in the sense of being an entry into the farming arena, yes, but at the right time for purposes of helping other farm people.
Oh, there you go.
It probably was very fortuitous. Because I learned from the people that I began serving. And yes, everybody was doing well in the late 70s and the first couple of years in the 80s until agriculture crashed. Yeah. We ourselves lost two farms during that era, but we hung on to our home place, and since then we added a little bit of land in addition to that. So it's worked out for us, and it worked out for raising our children on a farm because they picked up the values that come with working hard and being practical, not giving up easily, taking chances by depending on their own wits and efforts. Those were our characteristics that show up in successful farmers, but they show up in many people's careers. Our daughter is a physician, and our son is now an executive of a healthcare organization. So they both have stayed in the health fields, like Marilyn and I have, but they still have that yearning to farm. They have large gardens and John, our son, has often comes home to help me because he lives in Des Moines, and we like to spend time on the farm and thoroughly enjoy it.
And there you go, how precious that was. But when I brought up the notion of the timing, it seemed like the timing was right, kind of propitious, I guess you would say, for somebody in psychology, because you walked right into the door when the door was, the whole building was collapsing of agriculture. And so we'd like to pick that theme up and have you tell us what you saw then. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about farming suicide. Why is it that our farmers commit suicide at a rate 500% greater than the rest of us? A true tragedy. This is the Food Chain, right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
1979, very good time to get into farming, you would think, because farming was in boom times. But then came the collapse, and our guest today, Dr. Mike Rossman, farmer, psychologist, there he is right at the key point of collapse, and things were falling around all around you. What did you see and what did you hear, Dr. Mike, when things started falling apart in agriculture?
I started a full-time practice of psychology while also working full-time as an agricultural producer in 1979.
Wait a minute. How many full-time jobs can one person have?
Well, I was burning the candle at both ends.
That's okay.
I acknowledge that. But I was doing what I felt called to do. I felt that somebody needed to take care of the mental health of farm people because they weren't taking care of themselves very well. When the farm crisis emerged, the suicide rate among farm people in Iowa rose to about four times what it was prior to the agricultural depression in the mid-1980s. That was alarming to many people. It also even alarmed our federal elected leaders, such as senators and congresspersons, and who took action at that time. A number of things were created out of desperation that taught us a lot of lessons. Some states set up farm crisis telephone hotlines that people could call at any time of the day or night. They learned that farmers will talk to telephone responders who understand agriculture, but they wouldn't necessarily visit with people who were not familiar with agriculture. They also needed to be able to contact the telephone counselors at any time of the day or night, so that the hours were suited to farming or to farmers' needs. Often farmers called at night when they were feeling most dreadful. They would call on weekends, even holidays. So it emerged as an effective way of understanding farm and ranch people when they could call hotlines and helplines. That wasn't the only thing that helped, though. We set up a farm counseling program in Western Iowa at the mental health center where I was working. We provided counseling free through a grant from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. The counseling was free to all farm people who were distressed. We learned by serving these people in counseling what kinds of behavioral health diagnoses they exhibited most frequently. We learned that the counselors had to have an understanding of agriculture in order to be effective. They didn't have as much credibility if they didn't understand farming.
But just, so, can we pick
that up?
Dr. Mike, can we pick that up for a minute and I think about it. You know, the notion of calling for help, and if you're calling for help, you're desperate, right? It's just no other way. You're desperate. And you call up and you get somebody who works at 7-Eleven and doesn't know anything about what you're doing. It doesn't work. It can't work.
It doesn't work.
You have to have somebody that knows agriculture. So where do you find somebody who knows agriculture? I guess they found you.
Well, there are a number of people like me, but there are also a number of people who went to college to take up some type of degree that allowed them to work in agriculture in some way or other. Perhaps it was a degree in ag business, or maybe in advertising or marketing. But often they also had a yearning to work directly with people. These persons with a farming background then became attracted to job offers at farm crisis telephone hotlines and helplines. And they were selected because of their understanding of agriculture and their desire to help farm people, as well as maybe having some natural skills of listening well and being supportive. And with a degree of training over several weeks to months, they acquired the necessary lingo and knew how to steer the conversation in directions that would get at what was troubling the farm caller. About half of the callers were male and about half were female. The callers often set up telephone relationships with the counselors. The counselors referred them for other kinds of assistance they might need, such as legal advice from an attorney who specialized in agricultural issues. They might have needed medical assistance or agronomic advice, and the responders at the hotlines and helplines had several sheets of information available to provide referral information. If they needed counseling, they had a list of farmer-friendly counselors throughout the state of Iowa, or other states had lists that were suited to callers within their own respective states. Those services worked greatly. The suicide rate began to drop, and it was probably because of having crisis services available at times for free and follow-up counseling that did not cost money, because the most distressed people were economically struggling and they couldn't afford to pay for counseling. But they readily were able to receive counseling using a voucher that paid for their session. So those were two practices that became noted as successful, and eventually in later research that I helped to carry out, we determined that they were best practices that were identified subsequently by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. So I might say a word, if it's all right, about two other types of practices that also became effective.
Please do. We have a couple of minutes before the break, so fire away.
Okay. One was that we had to train people who did not understand agriculture in agricultural behavioral health, because not everybody has an agricultural background. Some of them were married to farmers. Some were people who had a yearning to work with the agricultural population but had never grown up on a farm or didn't know about dairying or farrowing pigs. And so we taught these counselors, whether they were psychologists, social workers, psychiatric nurses, we taught them some of the kinds of questions that you need to ask, and they were able to relate in most cases, not always, mm-hmm. but in most cases they could relate with farmers and ranchers. So training professionals to serve the agricultural needs was essential. Another thing that worked well were community meetings. Usually these were 4 to 5 hour sessions. We would ask a farm couple from a neighboring town to come to the church assembly or to wherever we were holding the workshop. They would open the session by talking about their own circumstance and what they were going through and how they were struggling.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask sure. you to take a phone call. Do stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back with Dr. Mike Rossman, who is a farmer in Harlan, Iowa, and also a psychologist at agbehaviorhealth.com. You can look him up. Dr. Rossman, we were talking about your phone service and all of the ways that you mm-hmm. folks in Iowa organized yourselves to, goodness sakes, it was almost like a war.
It was in many ways because people were desperate. They were taking their own lives. Sometimes there were homicides as well, where farmers marched into the lender's office and shot the banker. Those were, of course, very sensational actions. But they do happen periodically. The whole issues of farming's distress came out in the open during the 1980s. It wasn't just in Iowa. There were many states around the country that had their own telephone hotlines and helplines, like Oklahoma and Texas, Nebraska, Wisconsin. Many of these had to shut down after the farm crisis ended in the late 1980s and early 1990s, but some of them maintained and are still functioning. Some of these are the New York Farm Net. It's a crisis service that serves New York and some of the surrounding states. Vermont Farm First is another telephone service for farm people in the state of Vermont. Wisconsin Farm Center serves Wisconsin. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has a hotline. The Nebraska Rural Response Helpline has continued effectively.
So there's a bunch of them around yep. the country, but do we still need them?
Yep.
Do we still need farmer hotlines?
Right now. I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Do we still need farmer hotlines? Or are, you know, the farm crisis ended? Do we still need them?
The farm crisis may have temporarily ended in the early 1990s, but we periodically have cycles of prosperity and distress. We had one in the late 1990s. There was a point at which pork prices dropped as low as 8 cents a pound for a live animal. Nobody could make money, and that was a stressful time. But then there are boom cycles as well, and we had a boom cycle that began in about 2007 and remained as a boom cycle until early 2014. Now we're going through a four-year agricultural recession. We're seeing suicide increase again, especially among dairy farmers in the eastern part of the United States and among grain farmers in the Midwest and parts of the West where wheat and barley are grown. Mm-hmm. Prices for these commodities have dropped to a point where farmers can't break even. So there was a record number of foreclosures this year by the by agricultural lenders. So we're seeing a lot of stress right now. I can come up with the names of three dairy farmers who took their lives within the past 3 months. I can't say those names on the radio.
You don't need to, but you knew them.
I know of people that, if I don't know them directly, some of these are people who may have contacted me, or family members did to report, well, this is what has happened. I get many calls from all over the country. It's partly because I write a column that appears in many agricultural newspapers that are weeklies. It's called Farm and Ranch Life, but it's about how to deal with behavioral health stresses among the agricultural people. How do farmers and ranchers, how can they find resources to help them with emotional distress?
So how to survive.
What are the signs and symptoms? Yeah.
You know, you talked about, Dr. Mike, you talked about some of the things that make a farmer good also make it really tough for them to survive these periods of up and down. And one of the things you mentioned was the agrarian imperative theory. Would you take us through that, please?
Sure. The agrarian imperative theory is actually derived from our knowledge of how animals are territorial. Just like animals strive to acquire the best territories in which to raise the young of their species, humans who farm, we find the resources necessary to produce food and to procreate the human species. That is a noble calling for humans. It's essentials for life that farm people produce. And this activity is almost like a vocation or a calling to be a religious minister or a physician, sometimes a teacher. But it is a calling in which the people who are the most successful are able to tolerate great adversity. They trust their own judgment. That is both good and bad, because trusting your own judgment means you don't reach out very well for help. And consequently, many farm people who are distressed won't visit a counselor in their community because they don't want to be seen visiting a professional. It might signal their neighbors that they're vulnerable. But they will call hotlines and helplines, and they will, now more than in the past, they will approach a counselor, particularly if the services are confidential, are geared to their well-being as farm producers, and if the service is free. That is why Congress is now looking at establishing a national network of agricultural behavioral health hotlines and helplines and follow-up services like an employee assistance plan.
You know, you mentioned
the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance.
Farm and Ranch Stress. You mentioned that there's a paradox there, that the drive to compete compels them to succeed. You know, it's the drive that really compels success is the same that exacerbates failure.
It is, because we tend to just keep on working and overwork to the point that we deplete ourselves of emotional energy. Our bodies can only produce so much adrenaline until we become fatigued. At that point, we're not producing the beneficial hormones that signal well-being, like serotonin and norepinephrine, and to some extent, oxytocin. Those are often ingredients in antidepressant medications for good reason. But
You're going to have to hold it, Doc. We have to take a we have to take a quick break. We're going to pick that up when we come back. Stay tuned, folks.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
When last we spoke about a paradox, that the drive that compels farmers to compete, to succeed, to beat nature, to survive the markets, to overcome all, is the same drive that exacerbates failure. So when the market or when the weather or when something, it occurs to me that farmers are in charge of nothing. Is that true, Dr. Mike?
Well, we do have some control over our behavior. We have control over how hard we work, whether we take time to recreate, whether we have sufficient sleep, whether we make necessary phone calls to reach out for help. Those are skills that we can acquire and undertake that make us more effective farmers, but they also make us more likely to cope with emotional distress. What are the major emotional distresses? You've hinted at them already, Michael. One of them is the threat to the economic welfare of the farmer. Just as farmers strive to acquire the most desirable land or sufficient resources to farm, that drive sometimes gets in their way of it's so
surviving
that when they aren't succeeding that they feel like failures, and that is what leads to the higher rate of suicide among the agricultural population. We think there also is a contribution in many cases from exposure to agricultural toxics, substances such as insecticides. But what we did find is that the same characteristics that help American farmers succeed are those that show up in Australian farmers, in the United Kingdom, in Indian farmers, people all around the world, as you hinted at during the opening remarks.
So we're talking about the agrarian imperative theory, and I can't help but think, why is this only true for agriculture? Do other businesses have the same thing? Or what's causing farmers to have this paradox more so than any other industry?
Why farmers?
It's a good question, Sophia and Michael. Many of us do carry our agrarian imperatives with us into other professions. We mark our territories differently than animals do. Whereas coyotes maybe urinate in key places to say, this is mine, stay out. Humans' pheromones are signs that indicate this is my property, such as a street sign, or we put up fences to say this is mine behind the fence. In our work cubicles, we hang pictures. Those are our pheromones that say this space is tailored to me because, and I'm putting up my signs that I have this property and you are in my territory if you enter my office or my cubicle. But why are farmers more likely than other professionals? I think when we work the land, we develop special bonds with the land that produces these essentials for life that farm and ranch people struggle to or choose to raise. These items are necessary for people to live, and it is a noble occupation, as I said, one in which they feel perhaps they are fortunate to have God provide them these opportunities. But when they aren't succeeding financially, they feel that they aren't fulfilling their calling. They also feel like they've let down their ancestors who struggled to purchase the land that mm-hmm. was passed along in the family, and they feel like they're letting down successive generations because their children won't have the land available to them to operate. So it's a perilous calling or work activity or career, but it is also an extremely rewarding one, and it's a special one because it involves producing these essentials for life.
Right. I guess when it comes right down to it, you know, if you're working in a cubicle and you lose your cubicle, well, there are lots of other cubicles around.
Yeah, exactly. There's always something else.
There's a million other cubicles, but when you lose your land, when that's almost like sacred stuff.
And your community might not have some specific thing that you're growing, maybe some tomatoes or something, if that's what you specialize in.
So that's a tough one. I guess... Is there a job that's more difficult than farming?
Well, that's a really good question. agriculture is one of the few occupations in which we have second jobs to help us do what we love. Mm-hmm. So about 80% of all farmers have an off-farm source of income. One of the spouses or both spouses may work off the farm and then also do their agricultural work besides having the off-farm job. Or sometimes they may be seed salespersons or, you know, different.
I guess that pretty much describes the difficulty if you have two jobs to hold it. Right back. We're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it, it's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we do have a lot to talk about and so little time to talk about it with Dr. Mike Rossman, farmer from Harlan, Iowa, the heart of the heartland, and a psychologist, agbehaviorhealth.com, agbehaviorhealth.com. Looking into our future, Doctor, what do you see for farmers? We've got another ag recession going on right now, probably going to come out of it sometime soon and go into another boom cycle, and that's the nature of it, isn't it? Boom and bust?
That is the nature of agriculture. It's a little difficult to predict what will happen. We think that the excess commodities that are being produced that we think the excess will diminish over the next couple of years because other parts of the world with whom we compete can't compete or produce as inexpensively as we do in the United States and Canada and to some extent Australia.
Why can we do it cheaper here? Why can we do it cheaper here than China, which does everything cheaper?
We have large... we do, and they do a good job, but we do everything large scale, and we rely heavily on technology. So many of the commodity farmers are not organic, and they are using large equipment, herbicides, insecticides, anything they can to operate as many acres as possible. But it's a fairly perilous adventure because the rest of the world is also trying to produce many of these same commodities. We have excesses of wheat and rice around the world right now. We have too much meat in the United States and in some other countries. So pork prices are down, egg prices are low, milk prices are low because we're overproducing milk. Yeah, we had a dairy buyout, but when people got rid of their cows, they got rid of the poorest producing cows and kept their best cows. So the amount or the volume of milk that was produced hasn't really declined much. Mm. It makes for an interesting gamble to see if you can figure out how to hang in there and to raise the right crops or livestock in order to make a profit.
And when
you organic producers are doing it successfully.
Yeah. Well, and when you can't, that's when you need the help of somebody like you, Dr. Mike Rossman, right?
When you lose, people do need help.
Yeah. When you can't make it, when you're not making it,
yep.
When you're going to lose your land, you got to lean on somebody. What do you tell those people who are considering suicide?
To do just what you said, to reach out for help. Sometimes it's to family physicians for starters, or clergy. Sometimes it is to launch a phone call to a local mental health provider or behavioral health care provider. It will be possible if Congress passes the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance legislation, it'll be possible to obtain a referral to a farmer-friendly therapist and to have from 1 to 5 sessions free.
Well, that's so. We just ran out of gas, but thank you so much, Dr. Mike Rossman, Food Chain Radio Program.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.